Good morning, party people, and I'm coming to you from Moab, Utah. I'm in the middle of a cross-country road trip to go see my mom. You're driving from Las Vegas over to about the middle of the country, over to Illinois. And so as part of that, I'm just stopping at all kinds of beautiful places that I've always wanted to get to and stay at. Moab is a haven for people who do hiking, like gorgeous red rock mountains and arches. And it's being a car guy, I'm amazed by the number of overlanding vehicles that are out here. Vans, trucks that have campers on them, things that you can stay in off-road for an extended period of time. Just beautiful country. And I tried to do this video this morning at sunrise at one of the trails, and there was just so many people coming through and so many cars coming through that I was like, well, this is the kind of the flip side of being in a place that's really popular for hiking and camping and all that, is people get up at the butt crack of dawn and they actually go hit the road and try to go out and around and see things. So let's go hit your questions from over at PollGab. I logged off of the Wi-Fi here. Let me go get back on the Wi-Fi. So the top voted question was from Your Biggest Fan. Your Biggest Fan asks, do you have any plans to write an Azure version of the first responder kit, which can get metrics from Query Store and thus overcome the issue of DMV stats resets on Azure platforms? On platform as a service, we need a reliable method to analyze performance. No, because Query Store doesn't actually have those metrics. Query Store doesn't have things like every query that's run, what your wait stats look like in total. Query Store is a place where queries are stored. Does it have information about wait stats in those queries? Absolutely. Does it have things about the number of times that they ran? Absolutely. But it doesn't capture every query. And the common thing that people run into is the issue of unparameterized queries not getting stored in Query Store due to the sheer volume of the number that come through. So no, even if we did do that, that's only one database at a time, whereas what you usually want is aggregate data across of all the databases on a server, or things to tell you which database to focus on. So no, that's not something that I have any plans to even go near. If you're interested in the data that's in Query Store, go check out SP Blitz Query Store or Eric Darling's SP Quickie Store. SP Quickie Store is a lot like SP Blitz Cache, in that you can give it a top parameter, like go find me the top 10 queries, and a sort order, so you can sort by all kinds of metrics. Show me the queries using the most CPU, show me the queries that are involved in the SOS scheduler yield weights, whatever. Next up, TC asks, what are the most underutilized features for SQL monitoring software? Oh, that's easy, the manual. Over and over again, clients will call me and say, hey, we're having problems with troubleshooting SQL Server performance. Although we have monitoring brand X, we still just can't figure it out. And if they're really intent on saying, you know, here, let us show you monitoring brand X, I'll say, great, go show me, as of 6:30 p.m. last night, what were the biggest wait stats in a 15-minute time period, and what were the queries that were causing those waits? And you see a lot of fumbling around like it's a teenager in the back seat of a car at a movie theater or something. They're just groping around blindly, not really understanding what they're supposed to do, because nobody reads the manual for their monitoring software. Monitoring software isn't something that's super easy. It's kind of like SQL Server. If you don't read the documentation, you're going to have a bad time. And yet I still see so many people who just, they don't bother reading the documentation. They think it's all going to just fix itself automatically, and that's not how monitoring tools work. Drew says, Rocky's father says, what's the most common complaint you hear from, from database administrators these days? Is it a lack of funding for good hardware or cloud performance tiers, training budgets, developers? Okay, so this one's a little tricky. I hear the same thing from DBAs all the time. And the thing is, I know what the problem is, and no one will believe me or no one will listen to me. And when you unpack that, there are a couple things involved. One of the things that I'll say is, okay, I hear that you've been saying that for a while. Can you show me the presentation or document that you've put together in order to prove your point? And then you can immediately hear the record scratch. Wait, what? And they'll go, well, no, I've been telling them. Your doctor's been telling you to exercise more and eat better. Telling people doesn't always get the point across. Have you given them something in writing that says, here's a graph, here's a chart to prove my hypothesis that this is the main problem and here's why? And then they're always surprised when I do my deliverables as the consultant, I have a written report. I say, here's the executive summary. Here's what the problem is. Here's how to prove it. Now we'll go into technical details and I'll give you more ammo, but this is really for the technical people. We've already covered the basics in the executive summary. And then they're amazed that the company's like, oh, wait, okay, so Brent said to do this, we should do this. Not that they always do it, but having something in writing that proves your point just goes so much further. Otherwise, you're just old man yelling at cloud. The other part to unpack with that is often these people are wrong, because when I say, well, all right, now let's look at, how did you come to this conclusion? And they missed all kinds of things along the way, or they haven't been to training classes, or they're relying on some blog that they read once that was written 15 years ago. Those are the big complaint is I'm yelling and no one believes me. Sometimes they're yelling the wrong thing and sometimes they're just yelling, which doesn't really get your point across. It's been like that for decades. Now, some of that you could say is like a selection bias, because the people who come to me for performance problems, the DBAs haven't been able to fix it. But I hear the same thing from people who attend training classes, for example. And you certainly see it online all the time with these bitter database administrators. Z asks, hi Brent, how can an ORM developer get better at sending queries to databases? And how can a DBA convince ORM developers that a 15K character query with 29K output every 30,000 times, I don't quite understand what we're saying here, is not a very good thing and can be done better in a stored procedure? Okay, so sending 15,000 characters to SQL Server isn't that big of a deal. 15 kilobytes, every second as you're watching this video, you're dealing with an order of magnitude more data than 15 kilobytes coming in for a query. I don't think I've ever seen a SQL Server where I said, you know what the main problem is here? Inbound network traffic. Because if you think about it, your SQL server, doesn't matter, it can be any kind of server, has symmetric inbound and outbound network pipes. If the queries are so large, but the results are still larger, you'd be saturating the outbound network pipe anyway. The inbound pipe doesn't really matter all that much. Now, if you were sending a 15K query to get an integer back, that would be different. But obviously, that's not what you're talking about there. He said 29K worth of output. So I would just make sure that you focus on what's your server's biggest bottleneck and then focus on that. Otherwise, it sounds like you're kind of walking into a restaurant kitchen and going, oh my God, can you believe the spices aren't alphabetized? How can you work in an environment like this? Well, alphabetized spices aren't usually a restaurant's problem. Now, the second part of your query, or second part of your question was, can something be done better in a stored procedure? What do you mean by better? If you're going to do a better job of writing the T SQL inside a stored procedure, well, couldn't the developers do a better job of that same SQL inside an app? Couldn't they build dynamic SQL inside an app and achieve the same end result? I would push back a little there, because it's not like stored procedures are magically delicious where T-SQL sent in from the application is not. Could the inbound network pipe be smaller? Yeah, but that's not your bottleneck. I've never seen a SQL server where that's the bottleneck. So what you may want to do is come back to the developers and said, I've done analysis and the number one problem facing this SQL server is blank. And if you think it's inbound network traffic, go measure to see whether that would actually make a difference, because I got news for you, it won't. Yusef asks, what are the top unforgivable database administrator mistakes? Oh, this is an interesting question. And so I posed it to the audience. If you go Google for Brent Ozar, why DBAs get fired, I did a blog post several years ago where I asked the audience, what would it take to fire a database administrator? And it's incredibly hard because most people don't even understand what the database administrator does, let alone gauge its success. The clients that I've seen where they have fired a database administrator, because you said unforgivable, and unforgivable means fired. If something was a forgivable mistake, they're still around. But the clients where I've had where they actually fired the database administrator, the number one reason was covering things up. Like they said that they had done something they actually had not done. They said they were taking backups when they clearly knew they were not. They said that they had fixed a security problem when they clearly knew they did not. Drinking on the job and covering up for that was one of them, but hopefully that doesn't happen too often. But that the negligence and actively covering up for it seemed to be the big one. Negligence isn't unforgivable. We all make mistakes. We all need to get training and get better at our job. Lord knows I do. Ryan asks, where do you see the database administrator profession going in the next 5, 10, 15 years? If you do a search on ozar.me, ozar.me is my personal blog, do a search on ozar.me for predictions. And several years ago, I did a prediction on what the database business would look like 7 years from now. And almost all of them are coming true. It's been really interesting to watch how that happens. So I'm kind of like, yeah. If you asked me in the year 2022, 10 and 15 years out, I wouldn't try to predict anything. I wouldn't even predict automobiles 10, 15 years out. But like 5 years out from now, database administration, there are basically two database administration tracks. One is development DBA, which is making applications go faster. That's going to look exactly the same 5 years from now that it does today. We're still going to be trying to cut costs and make queries run faster with less work. That's still going to be a mostly manual process. I look forward to the days when that's more automated, but Microsoft isn't lifting a finger to get to that point. They're still, like for SQL Server 2022, they're still like, look, we're starting to fix parallelism. And I'm like, oh God, okay, yeah, whatever. So that's the development DBA track. The other one is the production DBA track, which I kind of think of as provisioning, backing up, configuring, and securing SQL servers. The language that you use to do that has changed over the last several years, and it's much more now about how do you script, in theory, if you're looking in the future, it's much more about how do you script automation out to build servers at a larger quantity or more predictable end result. But patching still is not automated. Patching is still absolutely painful, checking to make sure nothing's going on in production and patching it. It gets easier when you have things like always-on availability groups because you can patch a secondary and have it ready to go. But it's not like your job's easier with always-on availability groups. I think that there's still going to be a lot more of that job getting worse before it gets better. You could argue that platform as a service takes away some of that. I often hear people saying, oh, database administrators are going away because of platform as a service. Come back to what I said about what this person does. Provisioning, you still have to do that. It's not like Microsoft and Amazon is like, hey, you're building a new app. Let's slide in a database for you. We'll totally provision it for you. No, you have to go out and proactively provision these things. You have to ask for them. Configuring them, backing them up. Backing them up, platform as a service is starting to take care of some of that. But the backup options are still really limited, like 7 days or 30 days. A lot of organizations, for compliance purposes, have to keep up backups longer than that. So it's a whole new world of how do you figure out how you're going to back that stuff up in a format that can be easily restored in 3 years from now, 5 years from now. Securing, that still isn't any easier in the cloud. If anything, it's harder. And then troubleshooting when something goes wrong, that's still, DBA default blame acceptor. People are like, what's going on with whatever cloud database do we have? And somebody has to go track down why it isn't working the way they thought it would, why it's not connectable, whatever. Great example from one of my clients. They went 100% platform as a service, and the database administrators, the headcount didn't go down at all because they're still now so much more agile about provisioning things and trying new things with new environments and helping the developers go stand up new environments, figuring out how they're going to strip PII out of exports that they do for other folks. It's still a ton of work. Hanny asks, hello, Brent. My friend is searching for your article on your first day as a DBA in a new company and couldn't find it. Can you help him? That doesn't ring any bells. Maybe somebody in the comments will know what that is, but it might be really old. I don't remember that at all. If you ask me what I would do at my first DBA at a new company, I would build an inventory of all your servers, put it in writing. Dave says, of all the database projects, CI/CD pipelines you've seen in your career, there have not been that many. Do you have any recommendations or tips? No, I have not seen a lot of successful database project CI/CD pipelines in my career. I've seen a lot of people try to get there and then run into just one stumbling block after another and say, you know what, we're going to revisit this in 2 years or 3 years. But I have not seen, I can count on like three fingers, the number of successful CI/CD pipelines. And in those, what did they have in common? Multiple people dedicated just to the CI/CD pipeline. As in like 2, 3, 4 employees who did nothing but make sure the build automation tools were working, that would test new versions of the build and automation tools, that would teach the build and automation tools to the rest of their staff. They were deep experts in that CI/CD tool to be force multipliers for the rest of their organization. Does basically anything asks, I know your standard recommendation for storing SPBlitz first outputs are every 15 minutes, retaining for 7 days, correct? What would be the max you'd recommend if a friend were interested in retaining more or collecting all the data at more frequent intervals? Go buy a monitoring tool. Go buy a third-party monitoring tool. They're like $1,000 to $2,000 a server, and they specialize in doing that kind of thing, plus giving you a nice user interface to query it. I would not, period, full stop, do it myself. End of story. Herica asks, do you have an opinion for when the SQL log backup job should be temporarily stopped on a busy server for things like index maintenance, full backups? No, you shouldn't. I have a very strong opinion. No, you should never disable the log backup jobs, period, full stop. That doesn't make any sense. The examples that you gave, index maintenance, why would you stop doing log backups during that time? All you're doing is piling up larger amounts of transaction logs that you're going to have to eventually back up. It's not like that stuff goes away. During a full backup? No, your full backups can take forever. And what if they fail and your server goes down during the full backup? You have no way to recover that data that was lost. Differential backups? No, you don't need to stop log backups during these times. Leave them, don't touch them. Gulnaz asks, what post-update sanity checks do you like to perform after applying a SQL Server cumulative update? Okay, so I got out of the production database administration job 5-10 years ago. Because patching sucks, troubleshooting availability groups sucks, troubleshooting backup sucks, troubleshooting why the cluster is down sucks. So I unfortunately am not a good person to answer that question. Plus, I had so many failures after cumulative updates went out that I never could have expected. There was a cumulative update that broke no lock. how the hell are you going to check for that after a cumulative update finishes? That's the kind of backup that you, or the kind of feature that you would just never expect would break. So all you want to do is have a monitoring tool in place so that a day or two after the CU goes in, you can go look at your monitoring tool and say, did something dramatically go to hell in a handbasket after that? Midwest DBA says, have you ever worked with a very large company? He gives examples, Target, Walmart, GMC, etc. Yes. Are their database administrator teams full of highly skilled DBAs, or are they pretty much like everywhere else, one expert and just a few regular folks? So I disagree with your premise that everywhere else there's one expert and a few regular folks. The size of the company has almost nothing to do with the expertise level of who works there. I have worked at worked with tiny companies that had just one person, and that person was a deeply awesome technical expert. I have worked at giant companies where no one knew what the Sam hell they were doing. Those of you who have worked with me recently, there was one big giant company that had easily a dozen. Well, we're not going to go there. But I go in there and I'm opening up the hood of the car and I'm like, oh my God, everything's on fire and no one knows what they're doing. So I don't think it has anything to do with company size. What I would say is that at larger companies, you tend to find people who are going to be there for a longer period of time. You meet more lifers at large companies, people who expect to be there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And there also tends to be a different mentality towards training at those companies. At a large company like the ones you described, they tend to have a fixed training budget that's like a percentage of employee salary. Now, that doesn't mean that the people use it effectively. I know a lot of employees at companies like that who kind of see it as a freebie that they just coast on year after year, that they go to conferences, but they don't really pay attention to any of the sessions, or they'll use it to go party, or they just kind of pick sessions where they're interested in the speaker, not the topic. I wouldn't correlate those two things. Pessel says, who's the community's Brent Ozar for all things SQL security related? There's no one actively blogging about SQL security. There are a couple people in the industry who did stuff on security 5, 10, 15 years ago, but there's nobody who's actively blogging or presenting about it now. So I would just be really careful if inevitably somebody in the comments is going to say, well, what about Frank, or what about Bethany? And those are people who the name might come to mind when you think security, but that's just because you read a security article from them 10 years ago, not necessarily current with what's happening today. Null Pointer says, my friend wants to know the best way to get some type of high availability. They have da 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 da. Once you get into detailed architecture, it's really beyond what you want to ask someone for in a webcast. That's really where consulting comes in, just because there's so many intricate things with that. It usually takes me a day of working with a client of understanding what their goals and needs are, their application, their future growth, and all that before I can really recommend them a good option there. Alec asks, upon checking a table with SP Blitz index, do you ever drop indexes with a low amount of reads versus a high amount of writes? How do you make that determination? I talk all about how I do it in my Mastering Index Tuning class. Ladies and gentlemen, Mastering Index Tuning is a 3-day training class where you can watch the recordings online or you can take part live, and I teach you exactly the same methodologies that I've used at companies all over the world. Mastering Index Tuning, tell your friends. Preben asks, because like if I could answer it in 30 seconds, I would, but obviously I don't. That's why I have multi-day training classes to teach you how I do those kinds of things. Preben says, are you open to visit Belgium because DataMines Connect is happening? Yeah, unfortunately, it's in September. I'm booked about a year in advance in terms of my travel schedule. So I've already got travel set up for the fall and winter of 2022. It's good to see that people are starting to announce new conferences. What you catch them doing now is, because they're so desperate to start again, they're announcing with a very short headway, so we don't have much time to plan stuff. That's fine for most speakers, because most speakers don't have anything planned out. Whereas I'm the flip opposite. I try and plan as far as I can in advance. I have flights booked for stuff in December of 2022 already. And I'm already looking at what vacation I'm going to go do in summer of 2023, just to give you a rough idea. Lotka asks, how do you determine the optimal time interval for backing up the transaction log? Ask the business, how much data are you willing to lose? Ask the business, how much data are you willing to lose? And the business is going to go, I'm sorry, what? Repeat the question. How much data are you willing to lose? And they're going to say, as little as possible. So why would you back up your logs every 15 minutes or 30 minutes? Why wouldn't you back up your logs every minute? If you search for Brent Ozar, back up your transaction logs every minute, I've got a blog post explaining why that is. And the first reaction from database administrators is usually, well, oh my gosh, that's going to be the transaction log just always going to be backed up. Yes, but very tiny amounts of it. Whereas, if you nibble it off all the time in small amounts, as opposed to letting it pile up for 30 minutes and then gut-punching the SQL server to back up a bunch of log stuff all at once, users will feel that as a slowdown, whereas if you're nibbling it off over time, they won't feel it as bad. In addition, if you're worried about large numbers of transaction log backups that you're going to have to restore, that's what scripts are for, like SP Database Restore, which is in the First Responder Kit. You can just point it at a folder, tell it where you want the database restored to, and it's done. It's going to go script all that out for you and execute it if you want. Whereas if you think you're pointing and clicking through a GUI trying to restore, you know, a day's worth of transaction logs, even if they're taken only every 30 minutes, you're screwed. Mank DBA, this will be the last one that we do. Mank DBA asks, non-SQL questions. You've previously talked about some of your awesome cars. What do you use as a daily driver? I use my Jaguar XKRS. So it's a French racing blue Jaguar XKRS. 2012 or 2013. I always forget because it's 1 year, but Doug DeMuro's video about it said it was a different year. So I keep having to second guess and go back and think. I think it's a 2012. It's got about 60,000 miles on it. And so it's a very rare car. There were less than 100 of them produced for the United States in that year. And only like a dozen were French racing blue. So it's fairly unusual. But at the same point, like the values haven't taken off and appreciated that much. So it's crazy fast. It's got like 550 horsepower, 500 pound-feet of torque. Can spin the rear tires in like first, second, third gear, makes glorious noises, but it's super comfortable. I've also customized it with a ton of stereo gear and nice wheels. So it's at this point, it's really uniquely mine, and I'm not worried about resale value. I'm going to have this car for forever. It's just a nice daily driver car to have around. So that's the one that I'm taking on this road trip too, actually. It's amongst all my cars, it's also the one that's probably the most comfortable because the AC is fantastic. It's a modern car, whereas the other cars I have, right now I have an 86 Ferrari 328. Beautiful car, but the AC doesn't work very well. It's not just mine, it's all Ferrari 328s. The AC isn't that strong. The driving position is terrible. It's like uncomfortable to be in with the roof on. The only time where it really makes sense is in the fall and winter when the top is off. Then I have an 88 Porsche 944 Turbo. I adore, and it's a very easy to drive and friendly car. AC works great too, also. Practical, it's got a lot of space in the hatch, but it's only got like 20,000 miles on it, and the values on those are starting to pick up. So it's more of a special car that I'll use to run errands for stuff. And then finally, I have one other car that's even less practical, and I haven't blogged about that one yet because I'm going to pick it up as part of this road trip. I'm on the road for like 2 weeks straight. So you're going to see office hour videos from all over the United States. This particular one, I said we're in Moab, Utah. You haven't been able to see the rocks behind me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to shut up now, and I'm going to go move the camera over just so that you can see the rocks from over here. Let's step out of the frame a little bit, and we'll zoom in just so that you can see. Oh, I have the lock button on. Let me go fix that. There you go. So this is the kind of canyon type vista that I'm out driving around through the course of today. So thanks for hanging out with me, and I will see y'all at the next office hours. Adios.